because the combat early on is like pretty permissive, like it gives you a lot of things to do with one character. And that was kind of the point, was I wanted to have characters that when you start, it's a roguelite, but I wanted to make sure that every time you restart, you have a character with a full moveset that feels like you're not missing something from that moveset. And so it's pretty easy to try to experiment and try to just press things and cool stuff happens.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Game Engineering Podcast. Today, I am joined by Kevin Pekle, a developer who created the game Helvetii. Kevin went on a journey to dig up the historical aspects of Helvetii, so Celtic or Gaulish culture that lived 2,000 years ago on the land which is now known as Western Switzerland. Helvetii is a 2D action game with three playable characters, Divico, Renard, and Namajos. In this episode, we cover Kevin's almost archaeological adventure to gather the historical context and the design of Helvetii and other games. I find a lot of Kevin's game design insights incredible. Seriously. You'll be able to tell by yourself how well thought out his takes are. Enjoy the episode. Tell me about Helvetii, and tell me, probably we can start with the name, right? What does Helvetii mean?
So Helvetii is a 2D action roguelite game that's based on Celtic, Gaulish, more a little bit more specifically mythology. Hence the name Helvetii, which basically is the name of the group of tribes that used to live around the region where I am, which is kind of like Western Switzerland Jura that extends a little bit over Bern and just kind of like the extremities to Zurich, in kind of like in an overall sense. The Helvetii were like basically composed of different tribes, that were called like the Sekani, the Tigurini, and the Rorak. So it's like it wasn't just one group of tribes, it was several, like kind of a confederation of groups. A confederation of tribes that basically gathered kind of like on the Swiss plateau.
Okay. And this is Helvetii, like with the double I. This would be the group of tribes.
Yeah. And yeah, Helvetii is the kind of Roman spelling of the time for the group.
Okay. And Helvetian, how do I pronounce that?
So Helvetian, that's just basically another word to say that, like, that group of people, just okay. A more modern version of it.
And also, this is Helvetii, with double I, is a name for your game. Can you tell me about that a little bit?
Well, it's, like I said, it's a 2D action game. It's mostly centers around, this kind of time period just before the Roman invasion on the Gauls, and you have this situation where this young war chief from the Helvetii who kind of wants to prove himself, like, and he kind of sees the writing on the wall, so he's like, oh, I need to do something because I'm young and I'm unproven. And so he kind of strikes a bargain with someone who gives him a sort of nail and goes, hey, if you take this, you'll have the power of the gods to basically defeat anyone that you want. And so the war chief's like, hell yeah, that's dope, does this, and obviously everything goes wrong. He gets cursed, the whole land starts to get cursed. He got tricked by that person who basically wanted to open a sort of like break the barrier between the world of the mortals and what is considered like the godly, the god realm. And then, so he has to embark on a journey. He finds on his way, like, an old reclusive druid, and she joins them, and she also has with her, like, a young fox that got turned into a human kind of part way due to the curse, as it kind of affected things in a different way. And so all three of them, because they kind of want to fix this problem, just journey to the source of that curse that's in the mountains in the east, where where so the Pompon Valleys would be right now.
Yeah. There are three main characters in the game, right? The young chief, war chief.
So there's a one war chief called Divico. So he is based on an actual war chief of the same name. So one of the few named characters, like, yeah, actually somewhat loosely based, obviously, on a historical character. Then we have Renard, which is kind of explicitly the fox character. And then we have Namayos, and she is the druid who is also kind of based on a name, although, like, very, very loosely. I will say, like, this is not supposed to be, obviously, a historical game. This is more kind of like a high action, close to fantasy, with some based on based on Celtic mythology. So there's going to be some liberties taken on a few things, and I'll be talking also a little bit about that on some of the designs later on. But just said so that there is a base on that mythology, kind of like as a baseline. And the reason was because, well, I just found the idea interesting at first when I started making the game. I was like, oh, well, there's a whole bunch of games on, like, Nordic mythologies, Japanese mythologies has, like, there's a lot of games coming from Japan with that. Roman, Greek, and like a lot of, like, some of the antiquity, like Egypt as well. But I didn't think there was, like, that much around Celtic. Like, there were, like, some Celtic inspirations in other games, but, like, explicitly about Celtic mythology, not that much, and even less about Gaul. And there have already very, very, very few things. Like, if you say Celtic, most of it, people are going to think maybe of Ireland's, maybe the British Isles and stuff like that. Very few people, like, very few times it will have explicitly Gaul. So I thought, oh, this would be a cool exercise to kind of also go through, because I didn't know much. When you're in school here, basically, they really go over the whole subject, like, hey, okay, well, back then, 2,000 years ago, there were the Helvetii, these were the tribes, they were here. Okay, moving on, because the Helvetii, well, technically, it's not Switzerland, and I'm also pretty, like, if people ask me, oh, is this a game about Switzerland? I say, no, this is a game about the Gauls, about the Helvetii, because there's, like, a lot that separates kind of those tribes from actual modern Switzerland, like, more than, like, 13,000 years before kind of the end of that those tribes and that culture and the beginning of the creation of Switzerland. And even then, the creation of Switzerland was, like, in a very different area before it started to get bigger into those zones again.
So it's like a historical ancestor kind of relationship, right? It's not that in Switzerland there's a lot of culture coming right from Celtic or Gaul, like.
Yeah, it's very, very few. Like, Celtic in general, like, that's, like, you can't, like, it's not even, like, you can't even say it's a blood thing. Like, Celtic is not, the Celts were not really an ethnicity. It was a culture. It was tribes, basically, like this. So you can't really proclaim yourself Celtic nowadays. It's not possible. Like, they're gone. They've been gone for a long time. There are maybe a few things that kind of remain from that influence. Not that much in Switzerland. Like, there's maybe, like, a few festivals here and there, but it's obviously very far, very far from what could have been here. And most of, like, the bigger Celtic influences, you're gonna find them more maybe in the Western France and, like, in Bretagne, and obviously, like, in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, like the British Isles in general.
Where did you find the sources of information for this?
So the source were, like, from different things. I went to a few dig sites, because there are a few dig sites around here which I have, like, excavated, old villages just to see, okay, well, how did people live? What was kind of like the how did those villages look like? Talk to a few people. Was lucky enough also to talk with like a few archaeologists who kind of worked on those dig sites. Went to obviously any kind of museums, Roman museums as well, like local and just kind of like around in the zone. And the biggest thing that helped me was a book that was lended to me. Well, lended. I still have it after all these years from my old rights law and rights teacher. Very cool person called Daniel Schoeny. So hello, if he's listening to this, yes, I'll have your book. But it was a very useful book because it was specifically a book about Swiss mythology before the Romans. And that's an important part because a lot of the things you're going to find are going to be post-Roman invasion and assimilation. And finding anything that's before that is incredibly hard. And that was kind of like the main difficulty of this project when it came to doing research, is that the Gauls did not really have written tradition, like when it came to culture, when it came to religion, and all kind of like like stories passed down was all almost oral tradition. So there's very, very little that was kept. And so right, even today, it's incredibly hard to find information on, like, yeah, how did culture work? How was like the how did religion work? You can only go a little bit by dig sites, but there was no like kind of writing. The Druids at the time did not keep like stuff like that. And so when it came to inventing, like coming up with some of the stuff, like yeah, the gods or some of the monsters and stuff like this, it had to be kind of an amalgamation of different things. And also based on that book, which basically said that, like, yeah, a lot of mythology of the time, not just for the Helvetii, like not just for the Gauls, but was based a lot on necessity. Like obviously, like you have a lot of gods and goddesses of water and gods and goddesses of fertility and the sun and war and different animals, because those were the things that were the most important at the time. Like you have like the goddess of horses, Epona, because like, yeah, horses were kind of a pretty big deal. And then you look at different civilizations and they all had like kind of a similar deity that fills out the same role, maybe with a different name. And also like you have influences that maybe came from maybe like places more up north or things like this. That also already started to lead in, because people also already kind of started to move about. This was not a static world like we might think today of like, oh, people just stayed in place and that was the culture. But like, no, there was like already a bunch of movements going on. One of my favorites is like one of the things that was found 600 BC was someone who was buried in this region who was like someone of like North African descent, and they would like buried with like North African artifacts and objects. So it really tells you that, like, yeah, there was like already a bunch of people moving around that kind of like defeats our preconceived notions. But yeah, that book was immensely useful for that. And then after I had kind of had a base and just kind of like, okay, well, assimilating a little bit of that. And again, obviously not a historian, not like a not an archaeologist or a ancient theologist, something like this. So I basically did with what I had for a bit. And after that obviously came kind of my own likes, my own culture, modern culture, the things that I like to watch, things I like to read, and trying to at some point kind of like, well, if I don't have anything or if I don't have much when it comes to the legends and when it comes to the mythology, well, might as well reinvent or like re-explore some of those things with kind of like my own interpretation of those things, since, well, that's also kind of the fun part of it. So like I take kind of a base and like I'm trying to understand, well, okay, these were kind of about that, but and also the context of the game of these characters, how would they kind of form? Would they have like maybe a different shape or a slightly different role, and try to kind of make sense of it like that.
What was first? You coming up with those three characters and then thinking about the history and realizing that, oh, it would be cool to place this in the Celtic Gaul Helvetian context? Or first you wanted this historical context and then...
I think the historical context came first, even though if I just kind of like a basic like, oh, I want to do something in that time period. That I think that kind of came first. And I had maybe one character that I already kind of had in my mind, which is Divico, who I've had his design for like years, even before starting the game. I had like this character with horns going out of his head. Like, oh, I kind of want to make a story around this character. I'm someone who is very visual, or like even say audiovisual, I would say, in some even. So like, I like to start from like, yeah, very explicit sources on like either music or visual stuff like that. And I kind of work from that. And I had this kind of strong, visual identity I wanted to start with, which is like, yeah, Celtic, very forced, like very kind of like, nature-based environments and stories and that type of thing. And over time, as I started to design, then the other two characters came in. I think first Renard, then Nameos took a little bit more work. She was actually the only one who went for like a serious redesign. Because originally she was kind of like an old grumpy man. And I was like, oh, it's kind of sucks. I have like two grumpy men in the group, kind of like. And so I decided to make her instead of like of an old sassy druid who's kind of asked to wrangle these two unruly children, one very angry and one very goofy. And that worked a lot better. And after that, it basically just kind of constructed. A lot of it has kind of constructed as I went. Kind of one because, like, yeah, I was also kind of discovering some of those things as I went. It was also the first game I truly like directed from beginning to end. Like I had control on the entire design. So it was kind of that learning experience.
Yeah. Did you experiment with different genres for the historical context, or you always knew that you want to do like 2D action?
Oh, I knew straight that what I want to do 2D action. Yeah. I love action games. Just kind of like they're my it's my kind of my favorite genres to play and to make. Maybe like just straight up action or action RPGs. Or fighting games or stuff like that. I love the technical aspects of combat and game. I like to understand what makes combat feel good. I just like, for me, it's just fun. And like the idea of also like having characters do very cool moves and you feel very cool and stylish while doing them is something I really like. So yeah, no, the 2D action was something I was pretty sure from the get-go. Like, nah, it's gonna be that type of game.
And for me and for all the listeners, can you tell me where would you say the differences are between the fighting games and the action games, right? In this regard, like, where would you place Helveti and what's the differences?
Well, in terms of genre, fighting game really explicitly. Like when talk about fighting games as a genre, it's explicitly like versus fighting games, like your Street Fighters, your Guilty Gear, your Tekken. These are games which are like very explicitly, okay, these are 1v1s. After that, like a whole bunch of mechanics, but like they're really built around those types of versus fights. And they have very precise control schemes, and they have very precise kind of like codes and a language associated with them. So Helldivers is not that. Helldivers is much more loose. It's a single player game. It's just, I would basically just call it like a 2D action game. It's an action platformer, if you want, though, even though it's like not that much platforming. Genres in game have always been a little bit nebulous, but I would say in this case, it's just pretty much sort of like 2D action. There's also the term called character action or stylish action, which I use also pretty often with like games like Devil May Cry or Bayonetta. Our games are usually called character action because these are action games that focus around style and kind of spectacle as you fight. It's not just, you know, bashing the buttons and things like this. It's really like, hey, how cool you can make your fight go. And usually you are graded or like you're ranked based on your style. So like usually you have like Devil May Cry has ranks, Bayonetta has a rank at the end. Stuff also like a big inspiration for Helvetii, which I'm not shying away from. Like a lot of people have picked up is like Muramasa Rebirth from Vanillaware. It's like also a 2D action game, which also kind of has like a ranking thing. How loose that ranking is can vary. But yeah, that's, I would say like character action, it would be like a better like descriptor. And that type of game, because Helldivers was really made in the sense that I wanted to make an action game which feels good to play and also rewards kind of like not just your skills but like your inventiveness with the combat rather than just like mashing through and just getting the best items, like being lucky through RNG and all that type of stuff.
So in Helvetii, you kind of have like a screen or a level, right? Where you have enemies, you bounce around and trying to kill them, fighting them, stacking combos, using abilities. And after that, you get a score, right? For this kind of level. How do you compute the score? How do you judge how player did?
In Helvetii, so the score is kind of computed on the different types of factors. So yeah, we have a score that appears at the end of each fight, which is like ranked from E, D, C, B, A, and then S is the big one, called like traditional scoring system in those types of games. And it's based on like, okay, well, obviously, like the amount of combos you do, the amount of enemies you kill, the time you take, all that stuff. But also, like, so like there's some basic stuff like that. But also because we didn't want to be just based on combo, because otherwise, like, yeah, would you always be scored good just on mashing things and getting big combos, and that would also advantage certain characters versus others. But also, right, like it gives you points on, hey, did you manage to break, like use that mechanic to break someone's guard, or did you bounce an enemy against the wall? Did you maybe crash an enemy into a bunch of enemies? Like having certain interactions with the environment or like doing certain moves. Like so one of the character Renard, they have a parry. Like, hey, doing a perfect parry gives you points. Or like, yeah, bouncing an enemy against the wall with like Divico, or crashing an enemy into others gives you points. There's also spending a lot of time in the air, so if you manage to like keep like a long time without touching the ground, so there's a bunch of little parameters that basically invisibly will give you like points behind the scenes, and then there's also things that remove points, so like as time goes by, points kind of naturally go down, so you can't take too much time, and if you spend like also even more, if you spend a lot of time just hiding away from enemies, it will start deducting a lot, because also to avoid people just going far away and just throwing stuff or like constantly evading, it's like, no, you have to get in. The point is like aggressive play, but also like getting hit by like specific attacks, dying or like losing a life, a bunch of also different things will deduce these points. And though, you have all of this happening in the background, and when the combat ends, then you have like a little bit of an extra things, like some extra modifiers that pop in at the end that usually go tack, 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 tack. And then this gives you like a bunch of extra, and then it compiles at the end. It's like, okay, well, based on this amount, and if you're on this level, you're going to get such amount of rank, like this rank or this rank. And if you're like at a later level, then the requirements get a little bit harsher. Like in early levels, it's like pretty easy to get an A or even an S, because the threshold is pretty large. But if you get to level 3 or 4, then you have to play pretty good if you want to get those S, because then also big ranks can give you rewards. Like you have a chance to get a chest or like even a locked chest. So you're kind of encouraged to get those ranks. Those nice ranks will then give you rewards that will then help you get also better ranks. So it's kind of building this momentum and really encouraging players as they play. It doesn't come immediately, obviously. Like having bad ranks does not penalize you in any way.
Yeah.
But it's more like you go like, oh, the more comfortable you get, the more you're gonna get rewarded, especially in the early levels, which allows you to build more momentum and confidence, which is a big thing about the combat in Helvetii.
But the score, affects you psychologically, right? Like I'm quite terrible at this kind of games. I got an S in the early levels, and this was what kept me going for a couple of more levels with even though then scored like pretty much E or D for most of the fights.
Yeah, getting an E or D, like obviously, like, but I usually when I see people, especially in convention, I observe them, like they usually sometimes their first score is like will be E, like, oh well, like I suck. But because fights don't take a lot of time, and then they go and fight something else, and because the combat early on is like pretty permissive, like it gives you a lot of things to do with one character, and that was kind of the point, was I wanted to have characters that when you start, it's a roguelite. But I want to make sure that every time you restart, you have a character with a full moveset that feels like you're not missing something from that moveset. And so it's pretty easy to try to experiment and try to just press things and cool stuff happens. And so usually what happens, like people sometimes will get, they'll get an E or a D early on. It's like, it's not like fun, obviously, but the combats don't last long. And usually what happens is that very fast, like, once they start getting just a little bit more used to control, that rank climbs very fast. Like after that, you can get a C or a B. Like I've seen people like very quickly, sometimes by luck or just like after like 3 rooms, like suddenly they get an A or an S, because suddenly that just kind of worked pretty well. And that kind of gives them like, oh, you can do it. You can absolutely get that rank early on. And even if you're not that experienced, that was kind of built around that. So we wanted to build that confidence, and sometimes starting with a lower rank, but then immediately kind of seeing that, oh, that rank goes up. So there's this kind of like tangible progress that comes in very quick. And obviously over time, then you start just getting more comfortable. You also understand, okay, well, what works and what doesn't. But yeah, just kind of building that confidence pretty quickly with players.
You touched upon something that I found quite nice, and also I think you mentioned this on your talk earlier, that it's great to give players all the tools from the get-go. Like if you start with a character, you have full moveset, so I guess that it makes sense for limiting the moveset at least for the maybe tutorial or something, just to not overwhelm from the point zero the player, but not restrict the moveset, for example, until half of the game and then add additional ability. And I heard you, I think, saying about this on your talk. I think it's a nice design philosophy for this kind of games.
Yeah, so that was actually kind of something very early on I wanted to do. That's like kind of the pillars of Helvetii, because I played a lot of roguelites. I played Binding of Isaac, Dead Cells, Peglin, a bunch of roguelites of all kinds. And over time, like the thing that keeps, I like to play these games very aggressively, because also a lot of those games are kind of designed that usually the more aggressive and the more damage you can do early, the more faster you can kill, and the less chance of, like, the more chance of getting rewards and the less chance of getting hurt, meaning that you can like spend the resources more into getting more stuff instead of like healing yourself. That's kind of what I felt when playing a lot of those games. But the thing is, like, yeah, when you die, and I always try to go over certain things because, like, yeah, I like this weapon or I like this thing because that's just how I used to play. But then sometimes you die and you go back and, like, you feel gimped. You feel like I'm missing something. And then I'll replay a stage and I'll retry until I get the things I want, because at some point, when you play a lot of roguelites, you start to kind of understand what's good and what's not. Like, you understand, okay, well, I know from kind of probability and, like, just kind of, like, crunching the numbers that I'm just going to do better with this set of items and this set. And so this kind of, like, a recurring problem that happens in this genre. And that's something, and also, like, it's very dependent on RNG. Like, oh, like, you only get this cool move, but if you get this item, and so only, like, if I don't have it, I feel bad. Or inversely, you get sometimes certain items that are just, like, a net negative. Binding of Isaac has had that a lot. I don't know if the latest version, I think they've improved on that a little bit. It was just, like, items are just, like, straight up bad. Like, straight up, like, oh, I don't want this. Or even Peglin, that I've been playing a little bit on and off as kind of my game.
What game?
Peglin, okay. Which is like kind of Peggle roguelite game, which also has that a lot in my opinion, which is like, yeah, there are some items you like and there are some I will objectively just ignore or just like, oh, but these will just ruin the run. And that I want to avoid at all costs. And yeah, since I was making an action game, I was making a character action game, and so character action games, like, you want the player to have already this kind of creativity with the combat, and you can't have that if you give them a little bit from the start. And so it was pretty important to, like, yeah, well, why not just give them something that feels already kind of full and complete? Let's give them, like, okay, full combos, like an invincible dash and an air dash and, like, all this type and all the tools that you need that you could beat the game if you're really good. Like, it's not, obviously, I've seen very few people who can beat the game fully with the base kit, but it's absolutely doable. There's, like, even, like, certain modes where, like, certain people have been challenging themselves trying to do this with, like, no upgrades and just the items. But it's to have that feeling that, yeah, mechanically you feel that you have enough, that whatever item you get, whatever, like, god you get, and even without upgrade, you feel like, yeah, no, I can't do this, because it's based on your skill with the combat rather than luck and rather than just, like, having things locked behind certain things. It's not even necessary, like in my game, obviously, we're talking about moveset, we're talking about combat, and obviously it's not going to be the same thing for every game. Like, some games, obviously, you don't want to maybe have your character be a super powerful thing like this. But I take the example of, like, well, it would not be a gaming podcast without talking about Dark Souls, I guess, just to be something like this. But, like, Dark Souls is kind of an example for me, because, like, especially the first one, because you might think Dark Souls, like, is a pretty, like, you feel, oh, it's a pretty restrictive game. But actually, I find Dark Souls, like, it's pretty permissive in what it gives you very early on. Like, obviously, you don't have, like, great weapons and all that stuff, but the moveset, you have a full moveset, like, whatever the weapon is, like, nothing locked behind it. And you start with, like, an invincible dash, like, a dash with iframes, depending on, like, on your armor and all that stuff. But, like, usually you start with a good dash, a good roll, and all that type of stuff. And the game basically won't throw you enemies that just really go beyond that stuff if you follow the same path. It's very fair and gives you all the tools that you need, and you don't necessarily feel like you're missing something. At least I personally think so, that, oh, I died because I messed up, not I died because, oh, if only I had this thing that I clearly need to beat this boss. An example I gave during my talk during the game dev meetup was a game I really love, and about, like, I'm about to talk shit about Hollow Knight. which is going to be great. No, it's an amazing game, obviously. But there was one thing that always annoyed me in this game. And I guess slight spoilers for Hollow Knight, more like mechanical spoilers. But at some point, the game gives you a dash. And kind of like if you swoosh, swoosh. Dash is actually pretty similar that we have in and Helvedi is like also a dash that's pretty similar, like on a lot of like those kind of 2D action games. Dash is very fast, kind of like, and it's very like visually coded to show you that oh, this dash is supposed to be able to avoid attack, but it doesn't. If you dash into an enemy, you're gonna get hurt. That's how the dash works at the beginning, and I was really frustrated because for me it was so heavily coded and like visually coded in the fact that I feel like I should be able to evade enemies, but I can't. And so like it's basically just a movement option that's just not very useful for like yeah, you can be, I guess, like get a little bit more of air movement, but like it doesn't give you that much compared to like other upgrades like a double jump or like being able to zoom about. So like it felt like kind of like more of an underwhelming upgrade. And way later down the line, like near the end of the game, because after I played the game a bunch, like I found a Colosseum and I tried to play the game with that dash and I was getting frustrated. And then I started at some point, I'm like, well, screw it. I'm just going to kind of end the game. And way later, and I find a place and like, oh, you get the upgrade so that the dash is now invincible or like it has actual iframes. I'm like, oh, okay, why is this at like the very end? Like, why was this kind of split? Like, this feels like one upgrade that's been split in two for kind of like arbitrary reasons to just have something a little bit more. And that was kind of like the type of frustration that kind of like annoys me when you see something that's so clear. Like, I know, like it's when you feel that you know that the game is kneecapping you to bring like more challenge or like to bring more, like to add more time on the clock. This is also very common in like in a lot of when I see like a lot of indie games, like people who like a lot of students or like early indie games who want to make difficult games, and they usually all have that design philosophy that oh, we're gonna make it hard by just kneecapping you and then give and drip feed you the thing over time. And I find that always so frustrating because it's not fun. Usually most players can kind of notice that, and unless your game is incredible at hooking you in other things, again, Dark Souls might not be the most like incredibly permissive game, but it compensates by having like incredible world design, incredible level design, and presentation, like a very on point presentation. And most indie games or indie devs, sorry to say that, don't have that level when they start doing a hard game or something, I guess.
It's also like interesting because you were talking about Hollow Knight in terms of a game and the progression within a game. But also now when you played Hollow Knight and you take any other Metroidvania, you will run, you will feel, for example, that you start out and you don't have a dash, you don't have a double jump, you don't have this, don't have that. And you will kind of feel that at some point you will unlock them. So you're kind of expecting this. And for the first time when you were playing, probably for me, the first probably was Hollow Knight as far as Metroidvania goes. Or maybe like even Ori and the Blind Forest, I was kind of, you know, surprised and was, ooh, now I can do this stuff, right? I did not expect that. But you start to expect from the genre itself, expect that you will get these tools at some point. So you see like something that is far high up and you can't reach it. And it's like, okay, it's not now for me, but it will be once I reach this or that in the future. So it's kind of the surprise and this excitement where it was there at some point when it was fresh and new, it kind of wears out a little bit, right?
Yeah. It's a complicated thing for Metroidvanias. Obviously, it's kind of like this fine line to kind of like to toe around where like you want to tease your character, the plays a little bit with like, oh, like, there's obviously something a little bit here, but like you're gonna have to find a way. But also, you don't want to frustrate them by just like having something that's very obvious that's like locked up very late. So, And it's not like, obviously, I think this is like the ones that may do it very well. I think Metroid Dread did it pretty well, or things like this, where some of the more obvious upgrades, they'll give them to you very early. Like, oh, okay, well, obviously this needs a double jump, but like the double jump is maybe going to be the first upgrade you get, or something like this. And they're also going to make it so that, yeah, you're going to get an upgrade later, but you also feel like the things you have now is still like pretty dang good. Like it doesn't feel like the base can you use like that. Like it already works as it should. And the things you get later, like it will allow you to do new things, but it's not necessarily going to make that so much better or so much like that. Sometimes it can, but like, obviously it's either reserved like the very, like, the more gratuitous ones might be either to the very end, but the more obvious ones usually would be more towards the beginning. Yeah, Metroidvanias, or they will do the level design so that you will only start to feel the need to get certain upgrades by the time that you're about to get them, or something like this. And like some of the more egregious ones, like, oh, this thing way up, oh, it's going to be like I need some kind of flight ability. And that is kind of fine to have it later, because like it's not a core movement ability. I think it's mostly like, yeah, when you talk about really core abilities, are like traversal abilities, which are like a big thing with Metroidvanias, where you don't want to make your player too annoyed when they just have to move around. So stuff like double jumps, wall climbs, and all that type of things. To me, that should be kind of like, if your game very explicitly goes like, oh, like you're gonna need those things, and like they have so many paths or blocks, like you better give them some of those to me pretty early on, because otherwise I'm just gonna get frustrated. That was like, and like you said, nowadays the expectations with Metroidvania is pretty different, because some of us have played a lot of them, so we kind of know what to expect. And so usually new Metroidvanias will sometimes even start you immediately like, oh, well, here's the double jump, here's the wall climb from the very beginning. And then the upgrades you get later on are going to be kind of more crazy or more like original, or things like this, that allow you to traverse the world in unexpected ways. I think that's kind of the key, is to kind of keep surprising you with that type of thing, and also keep providing you like on the base thing. You still have like Metroidvania is also very much based on progression. As long as you can progress in a meaningful way, that's fine. It's the moment you get stuck and very obvious, like in a bunch of different places with like very obviously, like there was I forgot which, but I played like a little NG Metroidvania, and there was one place where it's like, it's clearly a double jump, but like it was a double jump. Like with a normal jump, you barely reach it. And that's like the fight, I think the one I hate the most is like when you feel like the base movement is just poor enough, but like you feel like if I had coyote jump, stuff like this, I could reach it. But like, no, you need that double jump to just get that extra like 30 centimeters to get there. And that's like, I think, the most frustrating ones, and when you just kind of tease with like with. You tease it by showing how bad your character is instead of teasing it by just showing how inaccessible is. And I think that's kind of like the core conceit. Yeah. Is that if you're going to tease your player, you really have to show like, oh, when you're going to get this, it's going to be so awesome. Not like, oh, when you're finally going to get a jump, that's worth a damn. Yeah. I think that's kind of like the difference.
I have to, I have always in my back to make sure we describe all the things that we mentioned. And you mentioned coyote jump. And platformers, it's this... Let me also know that I get this, right? In the platformers, is this jump where you're pretty much already off the edge and you still can press jump you will not start falling, you will start jumping, because there is this feeling... let's say not fun when you were trying to jump and the last part on the edge and you still cannot jump. Is this the same thing that, for example, if you just fall from the platform, you can jump mid-air?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, If you're already falling, I think if you can jump mid-air, that would be more like a double jump. But it's more like, yeah, like you said, like it's something that's very common in like, yeah, precision platforming. When if you start running off the ledge and then you have like, yeah, a little bit of time to still press jump because your character kind of still like, it's called coyote jumping because of like, yeah, the Roadrunner Looney Tunes cartoon where you have like the coyote who like runs with like chases around and like runs gets over the ledge and then it's like keeps kind of running before he realizes that he's over the ledge and then he starts falling, and that's why it's called that. And so yeah, this like very, very commonly used in precision platforming, also as a way to be kind of more lenient towards the player so that you don't immediately want the moment just to slip off the platform, like, and then lose their jump, like, because it's very frustrating to, otherwise you want that jump to. It's kind of like an expected thing now with 2D platformers. You have that mechanic. True.
And tell me a little bit more about design for the combat in Helvetii in terms of like what you need to make, how you need to make combat fun, like what makes fun.
Mm. So for us, well, first things first. Helvetii took a lot of playtesting. I think that's kind of like first and foremost. We playtested the combat a lot during the years of development. We have a private Discord where we had people like constantly play the game. Like we had like not a lot of people, but very motivated people who were all action game players or fighting game players. So people who were very invested in that genre and that I trusted a lot.
How did you get them?
They were like friends from other Discord servers, like friends I knew from a while, like, and certain people from Discord, from similar Discord were like, hey, if you're interested, you want to beta test this. And so that helped a lot. And also conventions, like going to conventions a lot and seeing how just people play and react. And I think in our case, in the case of Helvetii, I would say the first thing to make it the combat fun was like, yeah, to make it pretty permissive and empowering early on. That meant not immediately throwing your character into like difficult situations. Like this, it's not Dark Souls. This is like in character action game, and we want to build confidence. So enemies at the beginning are pretty much fodder. Like they're easy to kind of fight. They're easy to juggle. And so like, yeah, we have a whole system of, like you can juggle enemies in the air and like. A big part of the fun of the combat is like how long can you juggle and just like keep them into a loop before dropping them. And we wanted to give like a lot of weight to the combat, and even like lighter characters, we want to feel like, hey, when you get a hit, it has to feel good. So like using everything, like if it's a big hit, like, you know, stuff like hit stop, a little bit of a screen shake that you can't turn off as well, but like sometimes a little bit of screen shake on like the very powerful things. Having like good sound design, like when you break the armor of an enemy when they start to into a juggle, you hear a nice pop and like a little bit of particles, like it feels like almost like a balloon popping, and also gives you that kind of nice feeling. A lot of visual feedback in general. I think what helped a lot with Helvetii is that we really visually coded everything pretty clearly, both audibly and visually. So like when enemies attack, there's always going to be kind of like a high-pitched sound and a little glowing flash on the eye that tells you like, and it's always going to be timed the same way. It's always like a 1 second, like a 60 frame time before the shine and the attack. So once you kind of know that, you get that rhythm, you can kind of instinctively know, okay, well, I know what time, how much time I have before the attack is launched. Not always the distance, but at least it gives you that thing. If like stronger, like critical attacks, you have a different kind of visual thing and a different visual audio effect. So very, very clear signpostage for everything. Especially when you have a game where like, a bunch of things happen everywhere all the time. You don't want players to get hit by something they can't see coming. One thing we added a lot rather late, but that was something coming from a lot of playtesting. Like sometimes it would be a projectile coming from off screen that the players did not necessarily see, and it would just get hit, even if it was kind of slow, but it was like it would not necessarily perceive it because they're busy on something else. So we added now after that a little, if there's a projectile coming from off screen, there's a little bit of a light flash coming from that place that tells you, oh, something is coming from that point. That helped a lot. Like we saw the result immediately with people like, oh, they instinctively started to understand that, okay, something is coming from there. After that, it's like, yeah, just having also like, it's like a lot of small technical things. I might not go over all of them, but like if you're in the air, also having characters that can auto like correct their height so that you always are hitting something. You don't want to whiff an enemy mid combo. If they're slightly too high or slightly too low, because that would happen a lot early on. Like you saw the combo, but the enemy is like slightly too low, so like you suddenly give a kick, they would all go over them. So like we have a system, so like the character would just slightly reposition. If like the enemy was just slightly off, we would reposition it, or up or down, just to hit it. If you're not pressing a direction, that was given from my Dead Cells dev that gave me that very nice advice of like pressing the attack button without the direction. If an enemy is behind you, then your character will automatically turn mid combo. There's a thing like if you press or not the direction. So like if you don't press the direction, your attack is going to be kind of more static. But if you press the direction, it's going to slide more. So a bunch of different things. Like there's a lot and lots and lots and lots of little detail that went into making the combat feel satisfying. It was just like, it came from just so many parameters. And also just like, since it's a single player game, we also made it so that, yeah, your hitboxes are pretty permissive. So like, if someone looks at the hitboxes for some of the attacks, they're going to be huge. Because like, we don't care. Like, it's like, we just want players to be able to hit stuff and feel good about them. So like, be generous. I think generosity with everything was kind of like the motto. But we wanted the players to feel good about themselves early on. And you can't do that if you already start being a little bit too timid with what you give them. So like, no, like give them an easy way to hit. Give them an easy way to juggle. Don't put like important things behind certain skills. Like you have to make this, like accessibility was pretty important. Like this was an action game that we thought maybe a lot of people who never played action games might play this. And we want to kind of get them on board by just even pressing things, even if they're not good at it. Just like pressing things should feel good.
Yeah.
So
it's a lot of invisible things. A lot of things that, like, as a player, you miss. You don't know how detailed and how invested all these mechanics are in order for you to like feel good and be really magic. But I really like the breakdown of all the little detail things that went into making this.
It's what I like about combat. That's the reason why I like doing combat, is because for me it's kind of like clockwork. It's just doing all these small parameters, and then once you get it all right and like seeing it come together in this nice harmony of like in a fight with like everything from sound design to signpostage to all the little mechanics that you've done come together to do something that's very satisfying. It's like, yeah, it's 100 little things that have to come together to make something that feels real good.
Especially
for us, when we knew that LVD is going to be 95% combat. Like, it's a very combat-focused game, so we knew that we better make the combat feel good if people are going to spend so much time hitting stuff. If your combat does not feel good, then why bother? I think that's very important. Like, if you're making a game that's like mostly action, that action has to feel good. You can't like be lazy on that.
So, where would you say? Because on one hand, you want the Helvetii to be difficult at some point, right? Even like in the Dark Souls, but. You want it to be difficult, and on the other hand, you want to be permissive in terms of like generous, you mentioned, for the player in order with the hitboxes, so the places where are counted as a hit, right? The hitboxes. So, and all these tweaks that you make so that players will do what they expect to do, not miss by with by a little amount. So how would you say, what makes the game difficult if you spend so much time making it easy for the you know, combat perspective?
The first level, we obviously kind of make it easy in the sense like, yeah, we are very generous and we give a lot to the players, so that the first level has to feel more like, when the player, and even then we made it easy, but like some players will still have a little bit of trouble at first. So the first time they'll play, they'll be like, oh, it's mostly about getting through the level. But then as you get good, even if like the game is easiness, then it's about getting the good ranks so that you can get as many rewards. So like it's more like kind of a warming up session. But starting from a base where we're generous means that after that, we design enemies around that generosity instead of like, I guess it's the other way around, that instead of like designing difficulty first, like making something difficult first and then designing the moveset, here's like kind of the other way around where we design kind of like, okay, well, how we want the player to feel, and then we start to add up, like we start to ramp up as the levels go. So each level that goes on, then we start adding enemies that are like a little bit harder, like level 2 starts adding enemies that, okay, are much more mobile, for instance. So like in level 1, a lot of the enemies are kind of passive, kind of slow, kind of lumbering, that will maybe sometimes have a guard or a critical attack. And then it ends with a boss that has a lot of projectiles, mostly to tell you that, hey, you can dash with those, like you can to kind of give you this. And then at that point, once people are past level 1, we say, we like, okay, we know at this point they're starting to get a little bit comfortable, so we're going to start throwing them stuff that like, okay, now you have to start paying attention because otherwise you're going to die, or like you're going to take a certain level of damage. We don't crank it up too much at first, but mostly like we start to feel, well, how progressively, like, okay, well, the second level is like, okay, now you need to start paying attention to what you do. It's not just about mashing. So like pay attention to maybe like, and like what the enemies do. Pay attention to like, yeah, the powers that you have, or like kind of the build that you're starting to make. Famously, also the end boss of level 2 is pretty hard. Like it's kind of acts as a first wall because he's all melee, and it's just like he starts like suddenly has a lot of movement. So like this is kind of like the first wall where like a lot of players like, no, this one you have to learn. Like you have to learn this one because otherwise you're gonna die. And then level 3, we're like, okay, well now we're having more sturdy enemies. We have enemies that are also like a little bit more annoying, enemies that fly, like have different types of projectiles, that's some that can be staggered. We have a lot of also like levels that are also more complicated. So like the moveset still feels good, and you probably have a bunch of stuff that will feel real nice, but like we basically just start to find more parameters that you have to pay attention to. So now like, okay, the environment can hurt you, the enemies are more, and also like because we introduce new enemies with old enemies, so like you have more to take into account, and all that stuff. And then level 4, we then start to feel like, okay, these are just like tough enemies. Like these are enemies that have a lot of hit points, so that can just like drown you in status effects. And then we have a boss that just like has a shitload of moves. I would say maybe the last boss is the one thing I was like, I would have loved to make it more difficult, but you know, you can't always get them all perfectly right on the first go. But yeah, and even then we thought like, yeah, this might not be the hardest game in the world. Like we didn't aim to make something that was like ball busting hard. And also that's why we have normal mode. We have then a hard mode so that people are looking also for an extra challenge. They can play in a hard mode. And then enemies have a little bit more HP, and sometimes they have like more effects. Some bosses have new moves as well. And also the one thing we did, so that because you have an ending, you can play with one character throughout the whole thing, and then you can have a pretty easy time. Like it's not that hard to get to the end with playing one character, but if you want to get the true end, you have to play the 3 characters, one per level, and then you get the true final boss. Which is kind of like this nice challenges that's not challenged at the end. And that's what also I think is a nice way of making difficulty, because it doesn't make the enemies harder, but suddenly like instead of powering up one character, you kind of have to plan around, okay, which character are you going to use first? and then switch because like this, because the only thing that they share between them is like the god, but all the items are mostly unique to them. Like stats upgrades are unique to them. So the character you're going to be using on first level is essentially going to start with very few things. And so like, hey, the difficulty also comes from like, oh, you're starting with like maybe a little bit of a disadvantage. You still have a nice moveset, but not as much like starting against level 3 enemies with like a basically a level 1 character with maybe a like a god or something like this. So,
it's like the player also choosing their own difficulty, even though they're not doing it through a slider or like a drop down menu. They're doing this through the character selection, knowing in advance that if they select a new character, they will be stripped from items and need to start from the scratch in terms of the level. I also like your level design kind of philosophy to break down what you want players to learn in the mm-hmm. levels and then create a journey through this. Like this is first, you learn controls. This is second, you need to learn, for example, how to dash things. This is like, now you need to really understand how melee attack works with this boss. And now we can expect you, the player, to know how to handle these. So we can throw in more effects, more issues, more, mm-hmm. as you said, environment. I like the, I thought at some point that like level design is just throwing things like monsters and just, you know, deal with it. Yeah. But it's much better to think about the levels with what you expect player to learn from this level and then move on knowing that, okay, now the player hopefully learned a lesson here.
Yeah. I go back to something that my colleague Davy Javet told me, which always kind of resonated with me. Like, it feels evidence, but like putting into words, like it kind of like makes a lot of sense. But like, game design is a lot about empathy. It's about putting yourself in your player's shoes at different points and like understanding how they will see it. And so that's pretty much, I think, very true for level design. It's like you have to imagine yourself, okay, which state of mind are they going to be in when they get to that point, and like, how good are they going to kind of be like on average? And obviously that can be very difficult, and like also why there's like a lot of more modulable approach to difficulty. We also added, for instance, in our game, like in options, you can just go into the options, like lower the enemy damage if it's still too difficult for you, and it doesn't change anything. It won't like give you less rewards. Like, we just give this for free because like, hey, who cares? It's a single player game. Or you can also boost it if you want to put it at 200% and give you like extra difficulty for some reason. And yeah, it was more about like bringing the difficulty, and also like think about like, yeah, you could still then brute force your way through the levels at level 3 and all that stuff with the items you got or the stats you got. But there's still also that underlying thing that, hey, if you want to be good, like to have a character that feels nice, you still have to get good ranks. Like, by the time you get level 3, like, yeah, you could brute force with the enemies, but getting good ranks at level 3 starts to become also a lot harder against enemies, are also a lot more trickier. So at this point, you also want the player to feel like, hey, you start to need to use everything in your arsenal. You can't just mash melee or use a god sometimes. Like, use your range attack, use your melees, use your specials, because that's going to be the difference between just getting through the level and getting through the level and getting a bunch of treasure in addition, which will make it then a lot easier for the next one. Basically, we went like, hey, if you play good, then you're going to have just a much easier time for the next level and so on.
Yeah, if you learn instead of like brute forcing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about gods? We did not talk about that yet. Like how... Yeah. First, maybe let's start from the like historical context. You mentioning that like, there were gods in the Helvetii historical context, but it wasn't really enough to just take them and put them into the game. And then how they impact the combat and pretty much design overall.
Yeah. So from a historical perspective, so like, yeah, there is a pantheon of gods and like Gaulish mythology, Cernunnos, Tutatis. Like if you read an Asterix bande dessinée, probably heard some of those names before, especially Tutatis, Belenos, all those types of gods. Like, yeah, we're gods that were kind of named. The difficulty comes from the fact that, like, yeah, there was very few things actually written, like originally written about those gods. And most of it comes from basically interpretation or like adaptation, mostly by the Romans when they came in and just basically just like, okay, well, we're going to transform everything culturally so that it fits kind of our mold. And it's also pretty hard sometimes to just, when you go over these gods and like, hey, he's the god of war and sun and the sky, and this god or this goddess is also the goddess of also war but also fertility and stuff. Like, there's a lot of crossover between some of those depending on which source you read. I think like so many gods were basically like gods of the sky or gods of like fertility or diplomacy and things like this, or just like a lot of crossover. So essentially I kind of went over the things and then I said, well, okay, what are some of the domains that are kind of attached to them? Kind of what I explored. So some were pretty easy because like some were actually like in pop culture, like Cernunnos, the horn god, is something that also has been appearing in other games. Or some like Belenos, like god of the sun, or Aventia was actually one that I really liked because that's based on a like a goddess of water. Like there's also like hundreds of gods and goddesses of water, so pick one. But this one I picked because it's basically actually based on the village Avanche, or like the small town Avanche, takes their name from Aventia. So like, hey, cool, like kind of local rep.
Yeah.
And there, and then mechanically, that's also where it got complicated. The gods went through a lot of different iterations, either on paper or in game. Because initially, I wanted to have like, oh, it's going to be one god with one ability, and then you can get a bunch, kind of like in Binding of Isaac, like, oh, this god will maybe give you like a bonus to your strength, but this god will maybe teleport you around. This god will maybe like just give you like, reveal the map or something like this. And that will have like a bunch of different gods, like dozens and dozens that you could get. This quickly got into a problem of like one having to make way too much assets for each god, especially if I want to have like a fancy summon for each of them. And two, I was going to run into the problem that is similar to Binding of Isaac, where like some gods would obviously be less utilized than others. Like, obviously, people will want the god that can give you, like, that can do a cool punch rather than the god that can teleport you maybe to the treasure room. Like, it's useful, but it's not as cool, especially because if you're eventually going to fight the treasure room anyway, then it's going to have, like, a lot of gods that are just not going to be very much used. And then we have that same problem where, like, some things are going to be way more wanted than others, and that's what we wanted to avoid. So after that, I went through an iteration of just like, oh, maybe, well, all gods have kind of like, you can equip several ones at the same time, and they'll have different effects. Again, came with the problem of like, okay, doing synergies, like it was really, really hard also, like, because I wanted to have like a strong identity around those gods, but it kind of was very difficult to think like, how do I make something that's interesting mechanically? Afterwards, like, okay, maybe one god, like one power. Like, there was also a point where you could switch between, like, you have like three powers and you could switch them with the bumpers and use them. But that was very unwieldy to use, like having like these things, because like people would usually not have the mental capacity of like fighting, and then as they fight, switching and using it like required maybe a little too much. Too much brain power in the middle of like a hectic fight. So then I settled with two powers that you could just use with the triggers. And eventually I kind of ended up like, oh, we do different gods, but like it feels a little bit weird. And at the end, I ended up with a thing like, no, you get one god that gives you two powers, and also like it gives you like a bunch of passives. And so as long as you stay with that god, like, and you can kind of upgrade it or you can change it, and then it will kind of like switch around or those types of things. I would not still be 100% satisfied. Like, there were like systems, like eventually that was even like if I had more if he had more money, I would have liked to expand that system with like more gods and also like be able to maybe mix and match more abilities, something like this. So, but eventually that's kind of the system we kind of ended with, because it felt like, oh, you kind of have like, you kind of make like a bond with this god, with this particular god. It felt like it felt more significant to have it done like this than just having a bunch of different gods and stuff like that. So yeah, that's kind of like the mechanically the system we ended up with. I think mechanically it works pretty well. Like it's also like, and we'll of course we also wanted each god then to have like very distinctive mechanical domains. So this is also where I started to adapt visually. So like Belenos, god of sun and protection, so his attacks are going to be about fire and defense, and all of his passives are going to be about like, oh, give you more HP, give you like a life up, give you like stuff that makes you more durable. Kaldunos, god of strength, so like all his stuff are going to be about punching real good, like they're going to give you extra strength, or like, hey, the more life you have, the more strength you also got, it's going to be easier to break the armor or something like this. And then for like some Aventia was like kind of like sources where I felt, oh, well, maybe about mana, like mana regeneration, because like kind of like a important resource. Also like being able to inflict some status effects and something like this. The more complicated one was Kutatis, which is also kind of more interesting because like one of the more well-known gods in the pantheon. And I was like, what do I do with him? And I wanted to do something that was kind of like unexpected. So I kind of made him like, oh, he's going to be the one who's kind of like who judges your soul. And so he is going to be the one who basically rewards you if you take risks. So all of his stuff, like he doesn't use mana. He uses your life instead. And so the more risk you take with him, obviously the more damage you do. But then you put yourself at risk and then you are on very low health most of the time. And that turned out very well. I think I'm very happy with just how the six turned out, because I think there's a nice balance and not one of them feels like super overpowered. Like I'm never mad when I get a specific god. I'm like, oh, cool, this one. I'll roll with this one. Arteo was like agility and like speed and less stuff and like air movement. So they all have a nice domain. My only sadness is I could not add some of the extra gods I wanted to do post-release because we had a few plans. One of my favorite ones was when I talked with it a little bit about with some people, which could be so in the game we have Bob, the shopkeeper, who is an owl. And I wanted to have at some point like, yeah, you can spend maybe something like 100 coins and you get a summon, like a special, like unlock a special summon. That would be like called Yojin Bob, based on like Yojimbo from Final Fantasy, was like this samurai for hire. And then Final Fantasy, basically he attacks by taking your money and like the more money you give him, the most powerful. And I thought it's going to be the same thing with a big owl who basically does like a big slash attack. It's just like you don't spend mana, you don't spend the health, you just spend money. And there was like also a bunch of other ones that did not make the cut. And I think my biggest regret is like, yeah, I would have loved to have like more summons in the mix. You just have more variety. That and just like the few extra things, but
We can turn into more intro retrospective aspects of Alveri. What else would you like to change, or what you're proud of from Alveri? Obviously it's two different questions, two separate categories.
Well, I'm very proud of the combat. Like I'm very proud in general that what we set out to do was just to make something that was satisfying combat that feels rewarding and like a roguelite, and that seems to have really resonated with players. I'm very happy to see that in a lot, like all the reviews and the critics we got, and a lot of people's like, even like some of the more critical ones will say, hey, the combat and the visual and the story feels good, like the presentation is good, it feels very clean, and I'm very, very happy. I'm very glad that we put out a game that feels satisfying to play. That's like a good experience for that. So that our core conceit was successful, because if that wasn't, that would have been a major bummer. Could have like good visuals or anything, but like if the combat wasn't good or like wasn't fun to play, that would have been a pretty big waste of time.
That's also a great lesson for everybody. Like, if you're making a game about something, just start with the something, like design the something, and then like don't put too much investment in all the, like, you know, maps, visuals, and like tools around this. Just make sure that the one thing that is supposed to be working and people will engage in, like 95% of the time, it has to work.
It's very important, because like, yeah, if you're making a game, like try to isolate, okay, what's the core thing? Like, and if you had to make like only, especially like if you, before making the whole game, like maybe just like make one level, like, or like one small level, and like what's going to be the core design loop, like the core loop of that thing. And even if it's like, and like it can be combat, but it can be like narrative, like, okay, if it's narrative, like what's the presentation, what's going to be the narrative about, how do you go about this narrative? I try to really isolate what's the core unique thing about your game, and then really, really hammer that down and make sure that works before you start to worry about anything like visual presentation. Like, yeah, sure, that's important, and like visual design is important, or like polish and that stuff, obviously, or like story is important, obviously, but you want to make sure that the thing that the players are going to be spending most of the time with, that's has to be pretty damn good, so otherwise they're gonna put down your game pretty fast. What I would have liked to done better, I think story writing is one big thing, because that's something I took on very late. I'm not a writer. It's something I'm trying to also to do better for like my next project, whenever I start to get more serious. I'm like, I have a started to design some few things, but it's something I also wanted to put more forward. But like, yeah, the initial story presentation, like the like a lot of the story feels sometimes like some stuff missing, like the motivation of the main bad guy, for instance, is pretty unclear. Some of the origins of some of the things are a little bit unclear. So yeah, that on that aspect, I think we kind of had to really, like, we didn't have enough resources to spend on that. So, and this was kind of the problem, like we're a very small team, so it's me who does like all the visuals and the design and animation. I had like another artist who did a little bit also of help on the visuals. And then Isabelle, who did all the programming. And then we have a sound designer and a composer. But like nobody else, nothing for writing, nothing for like stuff like that, or like making cinematics, making things like that, was also all me. So that's also when I like, all that thing I kind of put off while I was making combat. And then I'm at some point, I'm like, oh shit, I have to make an intro. I have to write an actual intro for the game, because at some point I also wanted to make like a tutorial level, which is like the actual intro, but like, oh, we don't have the time, we don't have the resources, so instead we're gonna make a video intro, like kind of like a motion comic, because well, that was kind of like the cheaper option, but obviously it comes with some some restrictions, and like, yeah, this is kind of the first time I really wrote something from A to Z. And like kind of discovering, okay, well, it's really hard to write good stuff. It's actually a full skill that you have to learn. So there's also that. And I guess also my regret is, I think a lot of people play the game, it's like, yeah, this kind of has on the cliffhanger. I would have, because I want to have a fifth level. Sadly, we've ran out of time. And then sadly, the game did not sell quite well enough that they could add this afterwards. We had concept, we had everything, but like, we had to come with the hard choice that we have to move on. Because we don't have any money left. So that was kind of like a bummer on an otherwise like good experience. Like, I really wish that we could have, like, I would have gone that extra mile to do this. But like, yeah, if you like, we were all like, we all got like Isa and I were like getting also very tired by the time the game was out. We were kind of exhausted, and yeah, we had to kind of face the thing like, well, we have, both of us kind of want to move on and to other things. So
can you tell me whether the narrative aspects, let's say the some of the missing narrative aspects, or the depth of the narrative, was this thing that was brought up in the reviews of the game or the feedback, or this is what you feel that
both. Okay. Both. It was something that I already felt even before release. Like, I knew, like, oh, this is probably not gonna get a lot of good points. Sadly, kind of had to go with it, but and we had to release, and yeah, that came up in reviews. I think that was kind of like the one of the more common points. It was like not a super negative point, but it was like often brought up, like, yeah, the narration is not super in depth. It would have liked more, which I think is totally fair. Which is a shame too, because I think like I had actually like entire things written out, especially for the antagonist. I think the antagonist actually was the character I wrote the most things for. I even had a point like, oh, I could even make him playable. Like, he's such like character, and suddenly like oh, his origins, where he came from, how he got things, like why did he do this, and like all of that is not in the game. It's like, it's so frustrating because I'm like, I did all of this work. And like, it did not end up in the game because I did not know how to kind of fit it. And there's like very few interaction that you have with Octavius, the villain, which I think is a real shame because he comes out like as rather flat in the game. But I wanted to have him more like in this like interesting kind of like antagonists, but also like villain with like interesting motivation. So yeah, real bummer on that. It's like, also lessons for the future. I'd also like to maybe also not put off, and it's also something I try to integrate more into my design now, to really have a structural, like the structure of the narration already laid out, at least, so I know, like, even if it's not in details, but I like, okay, this is what you need like the players to know about or learn at this point, or
like in game, what. Yeah. Players at which point, what they need to know about.
Yeah, or just like, okay, well, the progression of the narration and like how does what, like the crescendo, like okay. What you learn about the player character, like the less stuff, and like how they kind of progresses, and then this kind of like.
Yeah, that's smart. That's smart to have it like a structured way, like even in the bullet points, right? Just to have it explicitly laid out. At this point, they have to know about this. So, like, we let's hint this twice and then quite explicitly say that in the.
I mostly go around like thematic, because I try to go with narrative themes. Like, what is the story about? Like, what's the overall theme? And then when I lay out levels of like this, okay, well, how does that reflect the theme? How, like, by the end of this, what has the player kind of absorbed from the thing? Even if it like not concrete, like it's not details in the narrative, it's not like, or specifically like, oh, we have to be at this point with the character progression. It's more like, oh, well, again, in terms of empathy, like, well, if I'm making a game that's about loss or anger and all that stuff, and then it has to kind of be reflected in how the character acts, how the level design kind of reflects also those aspects, maybe either visually or like, as you progress to a level, like this kind of like, let's say, yeah, you have to, the more like you want to increase the level of desperation. So like, as you go on, maybe it gets harder, but like you get also taunted by the villain more. Those types of things a little bit, even if it's not very concrete, but like, okay, I want the player to be in this place, in this kind of state of mind at this point. The one thing I did like with Helvedi, that's something I thought was pretty important still, is the campfires, talking about narration and all that stuff. Because even if we, if I'm a little bit bummed that we did not have like concrete narration of all like for the villain, one thing I'm happy with is to have those moments of kind of reprieve between levels, because I didn't want the game to be 100% combat all the time. I wanted the characters to still have characters. I wanted it to be in a kind of a fun way where like they just kind of interact casually, not just being always super serious all the time. So like we have the campfires where you can kind of like talk with the other characters, and they kind of banter, they do jokes, like they kind of huge dorks. They all have like a huge silly moment, like none of them know how to cook. And Nameos just goes barefoot because she doesn't like to wear shoes. Renard is their total gremlin who just eats whatever, and Divico's like completely insecure or stuff like this. And I think it's important to have kind of like those moments of levity to also help to relate to the characters a little bit more. And I think in that sense, that kind of worked. Like, we have some people who like, especially really like Renard and kind of like the goofiness they have. I'm also a huge fan of like the Like a Dragon or Yakuza franchise, as it was previously known. because it also does this thing where you have like these very serious crime drama stories. But in between, you can spend a lot of time with the characters like doing silly stuff or mini games, like singing karaoke, going in play like with race cars, like pocket, like little race cars with kids, like things that are just adds to their character outside of the story that makes you go, oh, like they're also like huge dorks and they're like eating good food and they like singing and they're like, so playing baseball. In the game, we have something like in the campfire, you can also like gamble and like you have voice lines for that. And when we added in the recent patch, like a cooking mini game, so like you can also like eating meals for everybody else, which has both a mechanical thing, but it also like has those extra voice lines that I find are very funny, but keeps adding that little layer. So even I think it's still also important if you have to be light on narration, but you can still do little stuff like this that just like through little interactions can still add a lot of personality to the characters that you play.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to share what is your something about your next project, where you're headed? Or is it closed?
It's for now? Like very, very like the one thing you can say like, hey, it's gonna be another action game. Surprise, surprise. it's probably gonna be more linear or like a little bit more narrative focused. I will say that.
Okay.
It's gonna be like pretty different in tone than Helvetii. Aside from that, like I don't really have much. It's way far off. I also like in the kind of in a have to decide also where I'm going. Like, I'm doing concept and sketch at the moment, but like it's 2024 is also kind of the year when I'm just also kind of like trying to find out what I kind of want to do. It's also a bit of a complicated time right now. Also being indie, like with the everything happening and the industry in general. So we'll see how it goes. But I really want to make something new. I think I have like another good project in me. And I really would like to like use all the expertise I had in Helvetii and make something that's like feels even better with combat, but also like fill out the gaps that I had with like narration and bring on something that's also more like unique. In that sense.
Okay. Where people can follow your work? You have the place?
Well, you can still, like, if you're interested by Helvetii, you can go on Twitter at Helvetii Game. That's all in one word, Helvetii Game. We don't post a lot of updates. Like, right now, the patch on Steam is out. Also, once you're sure that, yes, it is coming for console, we just hit a lot of problems with certification, but I think we got everything ironed out. Or just like a lot of back and forth, but that's coming for consoles, like the latest like content patch that we have. Otherwise, if you want to follow me personally on Twitter as well, that's OwlDev.
I'll put the links in the description, so there's no worries about that. But the places where you're posting.
I'm also on Blue Sky as just like Hoot, H-O-O-T on Blue Sky, because I'm going to stop using this a little bit more. And I do streaming. I did a lot of Like a Dragon, but also do, and I'm going to restart doing again game dev streams on twitch.tv/Hoot_Patoots. If you want to follow me there and just like spend some time with me, I do art, I do game dev, I do games. It's kind of my vibe going into 2024 right now is just kind of be more of a general creator for a little bit rather than like full-on game dev focus.
Okay. It was great talking to you. It was really nice.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.